I've worked in healthcare, I've worked in ag, I've worked in water. The veracity and utility of data in any of those fields has been assumed for years. Better ways to collect the data, to triangulate, to get to what's real, for, you know, as sort of like a basic in any industry. When it comes to the broadband industry, I've learned over the last couple of years, the carriers get to say what they want to say about a neighborhood, and they're allowed to get away with that.
Welcome to another episode of the Community Broadband Bits Podcast. I'm Christopher Mitchell at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota this morning, speaking with Philip Neufeld, who is the Executive Officer for Information Technology at the Fresno Unified School District. Welcome to the show.
Well, honored to be here, Chris, and so appreciative of what you do across the states.
Well, I'm really excited to dig into all of the stuff that you're doing. There's one thing in particular that I felt like I thought was a hypothetical, but knowing that you've been doing it, this the speed tests and all the different school devices that you've deployed, that's awesome to develop a real data set. So we'll get to that eventually. We've got a long way to go. We'll talk perhaps a little bit about this, but you are a man of multiple talents. you've had private sector experience. You have a lot of educational experience. You have a doctorate in education, an MBA, and a project. You're a project management professional. Makes you a very dangerous person, I think, for some folks. But
or as my wife says, it keeps me from getting bored.
Yeah, I can imagine. The place I would like to start, though, is if we paint a little bit of a picture of what happened during the pandemic, because you and I met in part because of a Department of Education study that was done in which we highlighted innovative school districts. And my understanding is, to simplify things, that the pandemic hits. There's a lot of students in Fresno that do not have home internet access. And one of the first things we did was gave them the hotspots for mobile wireless network so they could have local Wi-Fi networks that were powered by the LTE connections. And that didn't work very well. For some, it worked perhaps, but for most, it didn't really solve the problem. And so let's just start there for a second and tell us what was happening around then.
I was responsible for moving from not just what we had done in our personalized learning initiative that I've co-led since 2016, which is around the classroom, but virtual schooling and then remote learning, right? And we kept running into these things our CTO and I would call the neighborhood network problem. And it was pervasive. You know, students couldn't get online. And first of all, just huge call out to the resilience of teachers and students in that moment. But I started, you know, trying to get a handle on what is this deep problem? Because I've been involved in internet for business in my past lives. But really, the pandemic pulled the blinders off our eyes around, one, that there weren't as many cell towers. The equipment was older. And the signals, I literally took people, you know, you got T-Mobile phone, you got an AT&T phone, let's walk this neighborhood and what happened to the bars, right? And then for whatever reason, couldn't get a handle on it, the speeds of Comcast. And Comcast is really our only monopoly in a duopoly market where AT&T is exiting, you know, given that they're trying to get out of the copper business. That's our only choice, but it wasn't working like it was supposed to. And despite emergency connectivity funds, students weren't getting connected. So that, and I think the other thing that really woke us up was starting to pay more attention to the regulatory environment at a state and federal level, what it meant to neighborhoods.
And it's worth noting, I think, for people who aren't familiar, that Fresno may not be considered a large California city, but it is a large city for the United States of America, which is a funny thing to say. Yes. But what's the metro, the size of it?
It's about 750,000 metropolitan area in a county that's quite large, 6,000 square acres and a million population there. So it's both a mix of rural and urban in the county, but it's a reasonable size urban area. And to your point, it's got a pretty significant disparity in terms of wealth. 89% of our students are eligible for free and reduced lunch, which gives you a sense of the level of low-income neighborhoods. But also these students, when you give them the right conditions for, you know, modern learning, thrive. The challenge is that due to the ability of, you know, affordability, availability, and I'll call it performance. That's something we always forget about when we talk about the triangle. It's a quadrangle. It's a rectangle, right? How does this stuff actually work in these low-income neighborhoods? And we're really holding students back. We're holding their families back from connecting to healthcare, jobs, entrepreneurship, services that exist. And that's the big challenge.
Okay, so you are in a situation where you're realizing more and more the depth of the problem. That although there is wireless, mobile wireless connectivity throughout Fresno, and Comcast is more or less omnipresent, although there's some exceptions, that there's a lot of students that aren't able to get online. So, how do you approach that?
Well, and I actually wrote a piece for our own internal leadership and to start some of the thinking across some of the informal coalitions that we're starting to form in our region. And it talked about the multiple layers of this problem and the multiple dimensions of what solutions needed to look like. One was around how do we start advocating with the CPUC, California Public Utility Commission, so that we have regulatory enforcement for equity in every neighborhood to actually get the same quality of service. Look, I'm in an area within metropolitan downtown Fresno, and because our neighborhood's more affluent, I get $60 a month for a 500 meg connection. Phenomenal. A block from me, folks are paying $50 a month for a 50 meg connection, and it only gives them 10 megabits per second. That was one dimension is the regulatory, the advocacy work. The other is, okay, what can we do to change the reality on the ground? And using existing funding streams, existing programs that, like E-rate. And that's where he said, okay, and so I'll back up and I'll come back to that in a second. But how do we do things like LTE that are quick, that don't skip generations of students? Mesh Wi-Fi, other communities have done really well. So how do we do some things like that? We also were looking to see how do we expand our Wi-Fi footprint on our campuses, in gyms, on buses. We did school buses back around 2016, our first go at that. But by the way, we tried to, during the pandemic, to park those buses in neighborhoods thinking that was going to work and then do a Wi-Fi signal out of the bus, because that actually can work, except they can't get a good cellular signal in those neighborhoods. So that
There's
was
no
why.
place to park the bus
Right.
where it could get a good signal. Yeah.
But I had started back in 2015 working with folks, and I'll give credit to Kim Friends and some folks at Houston ISD. Like, how do we get beyond our problem where we get an internet break out of school, fiber cut or whatever it might be, and how do we stop losing instructional days for students who need more instructional days, not less? How do we get better than Palo Alto performance? Because our students, from an equity standpoint, don't need the same, but they need better so that they get the chance to rise to their possibilities, right? And so back in 2015, I started working on something called dark leased fiber. Not a good way to advertise. So yeah, leased fiber. And it was a battle with AT&T. They did not want to lose the money they left that would be on the table if they actually provided the leased fiber themselves. And they really, all they would have had to do is patch it differently to keep us as a customer. The interesting thing on that one, Chris, that's where I started to see some of the inequities around this infrastructure. All of our outages were happening in the southern part of Fresno where there's higher poverty. And the fiber there was older. The engineers would come out of their vaults when we'd have an outage going, oh my, I've actually, when you step on the fiber here, it breaks, right? And you get more outages. How do you change that equation on the ground? So we actually, Cynthia Schultz, Kim Friends, we put together a pro forma that anyone could come borrow, contract that anyone should be happy to say, yeah, we'll sign on with that. And I tested with multiple fiber carriers. And then we had a invitation to bid. Anyone could come and compete. And instead, AT&T brought their lawyers, probably 6 to 8 years of good, hard fighting through the bid process. We now have leased fiber that is 20 to 100 times faster than 2019. We're saving taxpayers $40 million over 20 years. And because it's a fiber ring with sub rings, it doesn't go down. Well, when it gets a cut, it's fixed within an hour because we have a carrier who cares. That's Fast Network. So I'll give them tons of credit. And the cool thing about that, and this sort of goes to the community resilience piece, I reached out to them after they won the bid. So there's, all above board. I said, hey guys, we've got a lot of public housing that doesn't have fiber reaching out to these complexes. And we need some way to reduce the cost of getting fiber there so that, at some point, I wasn't yet aware of the multi-dwelling unit challenge. We can actually get those things lit up less expensively. And they said, yeah, when we bring fiber to your schools, there's 110 new miles of fiber across the fiber desert. When we bring fiber to those schools, we'll bring it past public housing also. So big shout out to Vast Networks and what they're doing in the Central Valley. They care.
And so you're talking about the schools at this point are making sure that you have good connectivity to all your different facilities, and that when they're planning the route between facilities, they're going to try to make sure that they are going right by these apartment buildings that have high poverty to make sure that it's going to be low cost to later hook them up.
Exactly. And that's the ability we have with our purchasing dollars. And so we can solve what's necessary for the schools or the libraries, whatever it might be, where you're, or municipalities, in a way that actually changes the landscape of what's possible for, new cell towers or our own LTE system.
Yeah, so do you want to go next into LTE or talk about the data mapping? I don't know what happened first.
It was actually sort of both. First phase of LTE, because of these ESSER funds, we had 6 months to do what normally takes 3 years. We did 15, I called it buildings as towers, because you couldn't go, the DSA, the Division of State Architecture for California processes, year to 2 years. We only had 6 months to get these things installed. And we did 15 sites, in some cases 50 to 70megabits, which some people would call, and some folks would say, well, that's not great, Phil. I said, have you walked in these neighborhoods yet and seen what they currently get from AT&T and T-Mobile? And it doesn't work, right? And we've done a study, as you're aware, that CAT study that shows the economic benefits of doing your own LTE versus paying long-term for hotspots that are with a commercial carrier. So we did that. The second, and we did that based on the most impacted areas in terms of their ability to get not get a good cellular connection.
So in this case, the school is literally putting up wireless towers to transmit into the homes of
Right.
students using LTE technology, sometimes called private LTE, but the
Right.
school's doing this. And then you and I were a part of a study that I'll try to surface and get into a post
Right.
that talks about other folks doing this. But also, I should note that as we go through this, you have a collection of PDFs that are going to be in the show notes that people might want to pull up for a later part of the discussion.
We then use the data to inform what we were doing with the second phase, which is going to be another 35. These are true towers. It's a Musco 65-foot pole that gets the radio up to a nice location to get better RF signal, better overlap of that signal, and it's driven by the data in terms of where the highest needs are. So I'm real excited about that. That's due to Division of State Architecture not as moving as fast, but we should have that completed by the end of this year.
And so you have already been deploying LTE. You've been running that network, and you're talking about that you're going to be expanding it with these new towers.
Right. And I think, the other is we're going to see increased adoption, because remember in the old days when you had a cell tower and, all of a sudden you went to another's, you kept your car driving, or you might move and it's like, oh, it doesn't work as well here. I think we're going to see better adoption with the overlap and the better RF signal quality with those towers. And so that'll be a help, because this is the key piece. The regulatory environment hasn't changed enough to require Comcast to deliver the same quality of service in every neighborhood. And with, because I've been involved in the Silicon Valley Network, it's a partnership with the California Educational, the Emerging Technology Fund, in 8 counties to see, which providers would play with all the different fund streams that were coming up, like BEAD and the broadband funding in California for last mile. Comcast is not planning to invest in low-income neighborhoods, particularly in urban areas, or solve for what's happening in the multi-dwelling complexes. They're picking markets that they think they can lock in on, and some small, and it's good, some smaller rural areas. But essentially, for the next 5 to 10 years, there is no investment, despite all these waves of funds, in these low-income neighborhoods. So that we've got to, as anchor institutions, do something about that.
Well, and this would be a good moment to just note that to and through from the Shelby philosophy from the Schools, Hospitals, Library, Broadband Coalition. Tell us briefly about that, and then I want to come back to Comcast and just make sure we're substantiating some of the thoughts about that, because I don't want to just make general claims.
Yeah, so the Shelby Notion is, so that's Schools Healthcare Library Broadband Consortium. They advocate at a federal level with folks like the FCC, NTIA, the White House, Congress, do a phenomenal job. I'll acknowledge I'm on the board and super supportive of what they do. It's so important. So the notion of to and through here is, all right, if we're not going to see carriers invest in low-income neighborhoods, how might we do public private partnerships? How might we do investment on our own so that the taxpayer already funded E-rate fiber to the schools, for example, could use its existing capacity to serve the local neighborhood? How might it use that after hours to serve residents in these areas? Or how might it change what's possible on the ground in terms of fiber to actually make new things possible? So that's the to and through notion that's in so many places actually taking effect with municipalities, schools, libraries thinking differently. And in some cases, and this is just a beautiful thing where they partner together to say, hey, there's these every the way I'd say it is every one of our household has every one of our stake, each of our respective stakeholders. And if we're not working together, we're just not, you know, being real wise about the use of assets.
Now, when we go back to Comcast, one of the things that we've typically seen with cable technology, and I've seen this with Comcast, is that when they're upgrading a neighborhood, they typically will upgrade the entire, actually the entire metro, really. Typically, it's not the case that Comcast would leave some neighborhoods behind in this in a similar way that a telephone company would invest in just some blocks or some like neighborhoods and then leave other ones behind. The nature of the cable investment is it tends to be sticky, or in that the neighborhoods tend to be all done at the same time. Now, at the same time, I'll say in my personal experience, we also know Comcast didn't build all these networks. They were built by a whole bunch of different companies over the years, some of them better than others. And so here in St. Paul, I always had pretty good experience from Comcast where I live. And just 2 miles away, a network fiber network architect that I know who knows this stuff well, he did not have good experiences with Comcast because we're on different nodes. And so we see different things. So when you say that some neighborhoods have been left behind, this is not you just sort of generally saying it. You've actually collected data.
Yes, aware enough from a technology background around some of the topology they use. And to your point, yeah, they may have inherited some things. They may have invested in some areas, but there is sort of this notion that the poor aren't investable, right? That they aren't going to be a return. And I disagree with that vehemently. But the challenge here was we need to collect data to understand which students, for example, are having challenges connecting, because the reality is that the instructional, the learning material apps that exist, like Khan Academy with Khan Amigo, you've got built-in mentors. You've got really rich curriculum that's adaptive and helps you know where you're at and how do you do your right next thing. Reading Progress uses AI to immediately say, here's how you read and here's where you can improve. And it's so all these resources are available. And there's a good study by DeAndre Weaver from the Digital Promise talking about their impact on life trajectories, right? We need to get data on that. So, which students have a device? Which students have connectivity? Which students don't? Which students have poor connectivity? So that you can, hey, why don't you go to the community center because you're going to get better connections there. But it also helps us know which neighborhoods to invest in. At the end of the day, it also helps us understand how where we need to invest or advocate at a state level. I want to go back just for a second. I've worked in healthcare. I've worked in ag. I've worked in water. The veracity and utility of data in any of those fields has been assumed for years. Better ways to collect the data, to triangulate, to get to what's real, has been taken for, you know, as sort of like the a basic in any industry. When it comes to the broadband industry, I've learned over the last couple of years, the carriers get to say what they want to say about a neighborhood,
Right.
and they're allowed to get away with that, right?
There's no truth. Yeah, there's no independent measurements. Yeah, I mean it'd be like if a gallon was, like one measurement in one spot and then a different measurement in a different spot.
I worked in ag. If you were to say that, to your point, you know, there's a whole measurement measurements or and scales organizations in every state and federally around truth, right? So to that point, had to build something And I've programmed about 8 languages in my past lives, and I was like, okay, I can do this, but I'm not as good as I used to be. This is I don't have enough hours, between 12 at night and 6 in the morning to code anymore. So happened to hire a gentleman for our data analytics work. We've been working with Microsoft on learning analytics, something called Open Education Analytics. And Brian Alvarado, I give him credit every time because within 2 weeks of landing at Fresno Unified, I said, hey, here's what I'm envisioning. And he coded it and made it a reality. It's called My Quality of Internet, My QOI. It runs on every one of our laptops and it's open source for a very good reason. Any district can do this. Other districts like Oakland have modeled their work around it. We've talked to Baltimore, Chicago, and other cities who are trying to figure out how to gather this sort of data. And then what it does is it, and this is all configurable, it runs a internet speed test at 9:30, because you're assuming you're at school at that moment, at 3 o'clock, probably, after school learning, and at 7 o'clock. You could configure it to run more times. What we were trying to be cautious of is having it run too often and potentially slow laptops down. Now, these laptops are, because of ECF funding, emergency connectivity funding, all new as well, right? So we had 80,000 laptops getting 3 measurements a day, 14 million measurements to date, plus measurements, right? And gosh, in any field, you'd go, that's phenomenal. Let's use that data.
I assume that there is some sort of like offset, so you don't have 70,000 student laptops all at the exact same, standard time, pinging the same measurement server.
No, we actually do, but it's such a small, the ICMP protocol is so lightweight that it really doesn't affect the computer's performance nor the server's performance. We use Ookla, but we easily could use MLabs or some other backend servers. Part of the reason we use Ookla is they're trying to tell the state one time, hey, you can buy the data from us and you'd have much better data. And yeah, thumbs up to that. And I'd love them to buy MLabs data as well. But here's the thing. I'm dual citizen Canadian by birth. There's a song by Bruce Cockburn said, about a tree falling in the forest, right? It's about social justice. And the reality is that in low-income neighborhoods, because internet sucks so bad or it doesn't work, students aren't going to go, let's run a speed test. I know it's not good. So generally, tech folks like me who are like, my 500 meg network isn't working properly, let me do a speed test, are going to run speed tests. They don't run by default. And so, by having these laptops, all of them do the speed test. It doesn't matter which neighborhood, we get a good sense of what it looks like, all the way down to a very specific geography. And that's been helpful. The Public Policy Institute for California used that, for example, in one of their reports. Yes, it completely aligns with what we would call redlining in terms of where we see poor performance. This isn't meant to incriminate the carriers. It's like, guys, we've got data that is should be helpful. They should be welcomed, right? So Comcast makes over $19 billion a year after taxes. Where do you want to invest that money? If you created a better service for our urban population in Fresno and our Fresno Unified students and their households, boy, they would actually probably be happy to buy more streaming services and make you even more profitable. Our data shows where you need to invest. Come invest.
So your tests are collecting data then on your LTE network. They're collecting data on your in-school Wi-Fi networks. They're collecting data on the private networks that people are using. Whatever people, if a person's going to visit their grandparents in Seattle, they might be getting a test from
Great
there.
point. Yes. In fact, we were showing this to Oakland. And the interesting thing, because we didn't think about this, we saw a bunch of red dots from our students in Oakland. And then it dawned on us, students don't just sit in one house all the time. Quite frankly, out of sort of my exploration of that, I really echoed with other people in Shelby as we were looking at our 3-year strategy and mission, the notion of across the daily journey. And Chairwoman Rosenworth understands it as well. Internet access, if it's equitable, has to be across the daily journey. And if you from a healthcare standpoint, from those of us who have it, take that for granted. I could be in the mountains at a cabin at the coast, and occasionally I've been in spots where it doesn't work, and then I go, hold on a second, I should be able to get an answer to anything from whenever I want, right? We take that for granted. But in the reality, we've got to make sure students have access in their households, at the schools and community centers, between. But yeah, so funny to see these signals of our students in Oakland when we're talking to Oakland about this data collection.
Okay, so do you want to talk about the charts that people could check out quickly? And then we'll talk a little bit more about how much the CPUC welcomed this data set.
Yeah. So first of all, we can slice and dice this data in different ways. We can look to see where do our all of our unserved students live, and so you'll see a chart on that. But then we can ask, okay, where does Comcast have students who are unserved, which is less than 25 megabits per second? Similarly with underserved students. And so when you see these charts, you can definitely see where these different speed test measurements are. We use an approach that says if you're getting more than 20% of your measurements at unserved, you're likely to consider that from a user experience standpoint as unserved. Typically, the distribution is around 40 to 60% of the measurements are unserved when a student is designated as unserved.
Right, because you wouldn't expect that like every measurement is going to be under 25 in a given place.
Yeah. Now, it was sort of shocking. The city of Fresno took our data and actually looked at multi-dwelling units, and they were finding students were getting on average 7 meg, 10 meg. And let's remember that when we talk about how California expects the challenge for data to come in. So the CPUC says we have in Fresno County about 3% who are unserved. The census in 2020 said it's about 17%. It's a knocking on door methodology, a little more rigorous. Microsoft's digital equity dashboard, which has got a high fidelity speed test based on upload download speeds, says if it's about 47.8% of our population who are unserved. Based on the My Quality of Internet data, it looks like in our metropolitan area, it's about 27% who are unserved. And that's much different than the 3%. And unfortunately, that mapping data determines who's eligible for all these funds that are coming. And when you're not counted, you don't get invested in one more time, right? So that's a challenge. And then last piece, Chris, I'll talk about is unconnected students. Okay, so you give a laptop to a student. We've got unconnected students who don't connect over an entire academic year. And I don't know any student who, with a brand new laptop, is not going to want to connect. Now we're talking outside of school, okay?
Yeah, this is one in six students.
Yes, it's crazy. What's the value of the laptop when you take it home? And yeah, there might be different reasons that it's not being used at home. But that means no measurement across an entire academic year. And then so, and I was like, wow, but what about what AT&T and Comcast might say? And so we were one of the last ones to be able to use the Bridge to Broadband data program from Education Superhighway. They're an organization that does phenomenal work. And I really appreciate their current focus on multi-dwelling units. We take that 12,875 students who are unconnected. Comcast actually said they had, and I didn't know they're going to give us this data. They had 8,365, or about 11.5% of the addresses we provided to them were unserviceable.
And so, of the students that had never connected, almost 12%, Comcast said, well, we cannot serve that location.
Yeah. And I didn't know they're going to do that. I thought they were just going to tell us who's currently subscribed and who isn't. So it's, availability is an issue, not just in apartment complexes, but also in serviceable locations, right? So that was a shock. But I, like many others across in these moments, one has been maligned and kicked to the curb by AT&T when we were fighting for fiber to the home, fiber to our schools, better fiber. And Comcast actually shown up and said bad things about Phil because they don't like the data. And I've got colleagues in other cities who've had the same experience. I just wish Comcast would go, gosh, the poor are investable, and let's improve the speeds because they'll be with us long term, and we'll sell more content if we, improve the speeds. So that's some of the data we've gathered. We're continuing to gather that data. It's super important in multiple ways, including helping carriers understand where they can improve their service.
And I think one of the things that people should know is that one of the last third to the last, I think, slides shows your private LTE cellular network. You've put a lot of time and effort into a community solution, and not just that, but also in talking about like being involved in the regulatory solution for the entire state, because I think, and tell me if I would misclassify this, but your LTE network is it's a bridge. It's like a temporary bridge. Like if you're in a war situation, you just got to cross something. Like it's not meant to be the long-term solution.
Yeah, I agree. It's a bridge until we actually have the substantive investment of fiber to the home, every home in urban areas and in multi-dwelling complexes, fiber to the unit, and then really good wireless access across the complex. So it's a bridge that way until a better solution shows up. It's also a bridge network in the sense that it's the way, even if you had fiber to every home, back to that point about internet access across a daily journey. It's that bridge to connect people in that fashion as well.
And then you also on the final slide have a note about and this feeds into a larger problem that we've seen not only in Fresno but here particularly. You note that AT&T's application for what's called the FFA, the federal funds account, through the California Public Utilities Commission, there's a bunch of money available under a pretty interesting program to get connected. AT&T put in and they're proposing to make sure that a giraffe is connected in the zoo while nearby areas that desperately need connectivity are considered served already.
Exactly. It's beyond outlandish, right? And so unfortunately, they could easily have taken the $2 billion and not oversubscribed it and gamed it, but instead actually invest in those areas of low-income neighborhoods that most need this. Part of it is because the maps might not make them eligible, but part of it is truly a gaming of the system. There are municipalities, there are other carriers who actually are trying to make a difference, but it's at this point quite well gamed. Basically, they're taking areas that are more affluent and coupling with them with what would be the minimal number of unserved areas. And in this instance that you're talking about, they literally took the giraffe feeding 40 unserved locations in the zoo and said, "Hey, we're solving for that in some way, right?" Beautiful giraffes, I love feeding them when I get to the zoo, but I've never heard them say, "Yeah, Phil, man, I wish I had better internet."
Yes, yeah, they want to relive some of the glory videos of watching giraffes taking out lions on the savannah, I'm sure. I am curious though about the CPUC's reaction then, because we know that the California Public Utility Commission, we've had Shana on to talk about this, we're pretty frustrated with some of the maps they've developed. How have they reacted to the data set that you've developed for Fresno?
So the CPUC commissioner's offices, they listen. Their response often is that they're following the NTIA's guidelines on the challenge process. And just for the listeners here, the challenge process says for any particular challenge, you have to have a copy of the bill and affidavit that they're getting a certain plan. Okay. Here's the irony of that. The minimum plan is 50 megabits per second. And so, if you're getting 7 or 10 or 15, it doesn't matter what plan they had, it's unserved.
Yeah, there is no plan that has 7 megabits a second they could be on.
Right. And we in 2023, 2024, we should use crowdsourced, large scale data like this to inform reality in some fashion. And GIS and mapping and lots of fields to you can have multiple layers, you can have multiple sources of data to inform what's real, and somehow or other they're not there yet. Now, so they're sort of putting on NTIA, but I've one time had a short conversation with Alan Davidson, the director there, and his concern was how well would states pay attention to the challenge process in a way that made sure the money went where it needed to. And there was, I've heard NTIA also say, look, the FCC map's improving. States don't need to be held to that map alone. They can do their own improving. And as you know, Chris, there are states that are using this sort of data and have been for a while. And Shelby's got a work group that looks at broadband deployment and mapping. And California can learn from others. But so that's at that point. Cal Advocates, we've been having some recent conversations with, and they understand the challenge and are interested in trying to improve that. They're sort of a watchdog within the CPUC, if you will, and really focused on equity. The challenge right now is so much of this is driven by the incumbent carriers who aren't serving low-income neighborhoods, but they get to dictate how the challenge process works and who gets approved from a challenge. And we've got to find some way to have the capacity at a state to accept crowd-scaled data, but also give anchor institutions support. I haven't talked directly to Ready.net, and it's something I need to do. We need some capacity to take the data we've got, 14 million measurements, and then bring that to the serviceable location addresses to be able to say, okay, this, that, and in a form that the CPUC can accept. We've got to actually compete as states to get better at on-the-ground data about broadband, longitudinal, how are you improving things, or are things not improving, and really focus on the equity equation. If we really make sure broadband internet access is available across the daily journey, in people's homes of quality and performance, our learning outcomes are going to improve. Students are going to be better prepared as employers and entrepreneurs. Our national competitive stance changes. We're going to have people who are healthier because of mental health and physical health services that can reach into their neighborhoods, as opposed to forcing them to drive to some hospital somewhere, right? There's so many positive outcomes when this basic utility is available in a performative, and affordable manner for everyone.
Yeah, the part that gets me, and I push this down because it's not always productive, but I think it is worth surfacing to talk about sometimes, is that if we had a situation where it was only the poor kids that went home and had high quality internet access, I don't think we would see the state, the federal government, and the CPUC kind of taking this, yeah, the maps don't really work, but we're figuring it out. And maybe some year we'll have some good maps, like we're trying to figure it out. Like everyone knows poor people aren't served as well. Like, what are you gonna do about it? But it is pretty clear to me that if it was the wealthier kids that were going home to not having internet access, this would be a big priority, right? Like it's just so frustrating because your data shows that what we are doing to map and figure out where this problem is fully bankrupt. It does not work. And I'm not talking about intentions, incompetence, whatever. It is a hard problem to solve. And I'm just annoyed because it feels to me like they're like, Phil, your data is really inconvenient. We don't know what to do with it.
And we know from so many industries that this data is manageable and it's possible to do substantive work with it, right? We have started a coalition in Fresno County, and we're working potentially with other counties here called the Fresno Coalition for Digital Inclusion. And we're trying to bring this data to advocate at a state level. We're all working from the side of our desks, and there's political jeopardy in that sort of effort sometimes, but it's the only way we're moving us forward. I would just also want to call out Shayna and the folks at the California Alliance for Digital Equity who are working across California. We actually had an event, and you were at, Chris, right? That was so cool to be in space where people who are doing similar work, Patrick and Georgia from Oakland Undivided, to be in physical space with them and strategize because we need full-time advocates, full-time legislative analysts to move the needle on this because the technology is not the challenge. We could literally take all the one-to-one laptops that exist in K-12 and in higher ed and have much better understanding of where need is, and it wouldn't be hard to actually aggregate that at a state level.
Well, and I do want to say one other thing. When I'm you can react however you want, but I don't mind people telling me I'm wrong. I want my anyone who's listening to this show deserves to hear different opinions. But I would say that like you've challenged Comcast and AT&T to invest more in these areas and the wireless companies as well. And I think there's some merit to that. Although I also feel like there are real challenges to collecting revenues in these areas. We have done such a poor job as a country of making sure everyone has a real opportunity to thrive that there are places that have real poverty. In my mind, the fact that we have neighborhoods that are left behind doesn't necessarily have to be a problem that Comcast or AT&T have to solve. What drives me nuts is the way in which they're not saying, hey, you know what? Let's find a solution for these low-income areas. Instead, they're saying, we don't trust you to do this. We don't want you to upset our apple cart. We're worried that if you invest in these areas, that then it will later impact our ability to extract revenue. And so they're not sitting on the sidelines. They're actually in some ways working against a solution, is what I fear.
You're right. And really, we could partner with them to increase subscription as long as they're open to fair competition and fair pricing. But you're absolutely right. Think about healthcare and the subsidies that exist there to make sure everyone can participate. We need to think about those sort of solutions. And yeah, in some cases, if you're not going to show up in our markets, let us do the work. If you don't think there's a return on investment in our low-income neighborhoods, fine. Just stay out of our way then, right? But at the same time, I've shown this data to people like Sonic and others who literally go, we didn't know Fresno had a problem because the data didn't show it, right? So one, the data has to be honored to show there is a real need in low-income neighborhoods. Look, we want anyone possible to show up in Fresno to help us solve for this. And if you're not going to do that, please get out of the way. But for-profit companies, I've got businesses, I've had businesses. Yeah, you need to find a way to make sure there is a return. But the one thing I've known, and I served about 10 years on an international non-government organizations that did investment in economic development and entrepreneurship. People in low-income conditions do want better and are hardworking. And if we invest in them, as even as for-profit companies, there's still a return. And we need to your point, figure out what the ecosystem needs in different markets to actually have sustainability, and be equitable at the same time.
Well, and I think as we wrap up here, I'll say one, bring it full circle to you mentioning toward the beginning about the other industries. And this is one of the reasons why markets work when there is a price signal that is transparent, when parties have the right information. And one of the things that I find hilarious is that people who want to collect pricing data and make sure the market is transparent are accused of being some kind of like anti-capitalist socialists, when in fact, you know, if you want Sonic to know where to invest, they should be able to know how much AT&T or Comcast are charging in different areas and what the quality of service is. That is what allows for a competitive system. And we don't have that because our regulatory bodies have refused to collect and publish that information.
Yeah, agreed.
So anyway, I don't mean to jump up on the soapbox I think you lay out this data so well, and it's just really important that people, I think, appreciate, you know, that there's things that we can do here. This is not something where it's like, you know, the poor will be with us forever. We can actually solve some of these issues.
Absolutely, yeah. Because when the poor are given opportunities, they rise to the occasion.
Yes. So, thank you, Philip. Thank you so much for your work and for your time today.
Thank you so much.
We have transcripts for this and other podcasts available at communitynets.org/broadbandbits. Email us at podcast@muninetworks.org with your ideas for the show. Follow Chris on Twitter. His handle is @communitynets. Follow communitynets.org stories on Twitter. The handle is @muninetworks. Subscribe to this and other podcasts from ILSR, including Building Local Power, Local Energy Rules, and the Composting for Community podcast. You can access them anywhere you get your podcasts. You can catch the latest important research from all of our initiatives if you subscribe to our monthly newsletter at ilsr.org. While you're there, please take a moment to donate. Your support in any amount keeps us going. Thank you to Arnie Huseby for the song Warm Duck Shuffle, licensed through Creative Commons.